Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadelsky. I got my co-host, Dr. Carl. We got my chief science officer, as you all have seen him many times before on this podcast, Dr. Grant Tinsley. We have a special guest, prolific Dr. Stephen Heimsfeld. He's a physician at the Pennington. And, you know, we always talk about Dr. Tinsley being, you know, the renowned body composition guy, but this is the OG body composition guy who Grant learned a lot from. So we had him on the podcast. We're having him on podcast today because he was the big author on the recent Believe trial, which combined bimagrumab with semaglutide.
Semaglutide.
And we've been talking about myostatin, semaglutide. We've been talking about this for a little bit. We had Grant go on and talk about myostatin and some of these new medicines that are coming out, but we figured we'd get the head honcho right here. So welcome to the podcast, Dr. Heimsfeld.
Great. Thanks, Spencer.
Yeah, thanks. So just a little bit of background. You're Pennington. You've written many peer-reviewed, like, I don't know, I was reading on your CV, maybe 600 or more peer-reviewed articles. You're at the Pennington researching body composition. You've taught Grant everything he knows about body composition.
I don't know about that, but
yeah.
What? Just some background. What made you get into the body composition thing?
Well, I've been interested in it for a long time, and I have sort of a technical background. I went to engineering high school, and a lot of the body composition work has technology involved with it, the devices. So that's a natural inclination I have, although I am a physician. So, I started through medical school, but when I got out, that captured my interest was, how to make these devices to measure body composition.
But like, why body composition? You're interested in the engineering around it, but like, was it just the engineering, or was it like, this is cool? Like, I like muscle or whatever.
Yeah, obviously you got into, you know, obesity medicine, kind of diabetes, metabolic health stuff. How did that journey go?
Well, I trained in cardiology, and some of the patients at the time I saw had marked wasting from congestive heart failure and other medical conditions. I got very interested in the sort of wasting diseases called cachexia. And so people with heart failure have that form of cachexia, but so do patients with cancer and other diseases where you lose weight and particularly lose muscle. I got curious about how you measure it, and that's what sort of brought me into the field.
Oh, nice.
Now we know the origin story.
Yeah.
Very good. I'd love to have you sometime on again and do the whole history of the body mass index, because listened to your lecture a few years ago, and it was just, I hadn't heard anybody give it that much of detail before, and so we'll save that for another time. But
sure.
How'd you get involved with bimagrumab?
Well, as a physician, one of my early colleagues who was very interested in nutrition, metabolism, Ronan Rubinoff. He's a physician, MD, PhD, and he, many, many years ago, he went off to industry, and he went to Novartis. And he and I had very common interests in heart failure and cachexia, and then later what became sarcopenia, age-related muscle loss. And when he got to Novartis, he talked them into developing drugs that would build muscle mass and treat or prevent sarcopenia. And Ronan then developed that drug, bimagrumab, and it developed over many years at Novartis. And then Novartis eventually decided they were not interested in sarcopenia, and they sold off the drug to another company, Versanis. And Versanis thought, well, at the time, what happened was they discovered that when they were treating patients with sarcopenia, that some of them lost weight. That was a surprise because this drug builds muscle mass. And they were very surprised by the weight loss. And make a long story short, that carried them into the area of treatment of obesity. Because it had not been previously anticipated that weight loss would follow the treatment with this drug.
That's interesting. My brother and I were, it was maybe 2016 when we saw, it was either a phase one or phase two using bimagrumab for type 2 diabetes. I remember, and we're like, holy cow, we always liked myostatin. We have a history of wrestling and trying to build muscle since early 2000s and the 90s, really, even when we were really young. And so we're like, myostatin, this is cool. It's even going to treat type 2 diabetes. So it was on our radar back then. It's really interesting hearing the sarcopenia story. Can you describe what bimagrumab is? We've done it before, but I'd like to hear kind of how you would describe it.
Bimagrumab. It's a hard one to pronounce. Yeah. But BIMA is a monoclonal antibody that Novartis first made, and then later Lilly now has. It's a monoclonal antibody, and as an antibody, it has to be infused intravenously. So you can make these antibodies. And as a particular antibody, has a very specific selective action on what's called the activin receptor. And the activin receptor is primarily in skeletal muscle, and it's where the different ligands, these are the activators of the receptor, act. So myostatin is one of the ligands for the activin receptor. Activin is another, and there are a number of other ligands. So it's a very central station for when you block that receptor, muscles grow. What bimagrumab is basically an antagonist of the activin receptor. When it locks into it, these other ligands can't work, and it's a negative effect. When you block the receptor, the muscles grow. It's the opposite of what you would think. Normally, when you activate a receptor, things increase. Here, the effects are opposite. So when you block the receptor, muscles grow.
Very cool. Yeah. Dr. Tinsley brought us through the story of, cow and the...
And the dog, right?
And the dog.
People love that.
Some of the myostatin mutations in animals and the hypermuscular animals.
Spencer thinks that's my
problem. For many years that the double muscling in cattle, and you can make it happen in a mouse using genetic engineering models, the mighty mouse, basically. And there are a few humans, you probably know that, that have the mutation, but to my understanding, it's quite a rare natural mutation in humans.
Yeah, my brother has that one, at least.
If that were true, I would think my calves would be bigger, but
yeah.
Very cool. Okay, so that kind of sets up the stage. Why did they decide to put this along? We talked about this before ad nauseum, but why did they decide to combine it with a GLP-1 receptor agonist?
The GLP-1 receptor agonists actually have the opposite problem. When you treat people with these drugs, they lose a lot of weight. And when you lose a lot of weight, by any means, you lose not just fat, but you lose muscle and other lean components. And that's generally not considered good. So we know that the incretins, of which semaglutide is one, produce not just fat loss, but muscle loss. So the obvious question is there a way to prevent that muscle loss and prevent the functional deficits that go with that? And that was the origin of combining the two drugs.
Perfect. All right. Yeah. Let's go over to the design of the trial then. How is it set up?
This trial, I think you have to understand, it began... when Novartis was releasing the drug to this company called Versanis. It was a branch of Novartis originally, and then it got purchased by Lilly. So it's the drug traveled around. So the original study was spun off into Versanis. And so Versanis chose semaglutide as the GLP-1 agonist. Now, that's a drug made by Novo Nordisk, not Lilly. Lilly makes another drug, as you probably know, tirzepatide. Anyway, the way the study got designed originally was what we would call proof of concept. Does it work? Does it prevent the muscle loss? And to do that, they created a very complicated design. There were 9 groups in this study. And to this day, I still can't recite all the groups in order, but there are 9 groups. But it really, I think that, you know, there were questions about dosing of the drug and combinations, and got placebo groups and complicated study design that I think today probably wouldn't have gone forward, but Versanis at the time had a lot of ideas they wanted to try. So there were 9 groups, but it really boils down to 3 simple groups. There's a group with bimagrumab alone, there's a group with semaglutide alone, and there's a combination. Those are the 3 main groups out of the 9.
Am I saying that wrong? Is it bimagrumab instead of bimagrumab?
You can say it either way. Bimagrumab.
No, I like to be correct, so I don't know what...
Bimagrumab is probably the better way. And you understand that all of these monoclonal antibodies end in AB, antibody.
Yep, very good.
That's
okay.
A common feature of all of them.
There were about 500 people in total in the trial. It was 48 weeks. Is that
right?
Right. And what happened to the placebo group? Obviously, they didn't get anything. It looks like they lost.
Yeah, there was a placebo group. They didn't get anything. And eventually, I believe later on in the study, it does go past 48 weeks. And the placebo group was switched to an active treatment group.
Okay. Did they get dietary counseling or some sort of counseling? I'm looking through the...
Yes. In all clinical trials of incretins or any weight loss agent, the FDA requires that there's some lifestyle measure, counseling, but not anything like, oh, you know, here's your 500 calorie a day diet. No. It's your counsel to reduce your food intake and increase your activity.
Yeah. Kind of standard of care, what you'd see in like a regular clinic, I suppose.
It is. And the labels on these drugs, you know, when you buy the drug and there's a label on it, it always says use in conjunction with lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. What's the, when you say the 3 different groups, What's like the big takeaways from the differences here?
Well, there's some fascinating findings. At least they're fascinating to me. In the bimagrumab group alone, interestingly, there was a fair amount of weight loss. And that, I say that I'm surprised in a sense, because the weight loss was entirely fat. The lean mass, as we'll call it, increased in that group. It increased to a small extent. So those 2 net, that is the change in weights, the difference between the loss in fat and the gain in lean. So you would lose even more weight if you lost the lean and the fat together. So it's remarkably, it could almost be a standalone drug by itself. The weight loss was I believe around 7% or something like that. It was pretty good weight loss. Keep in mind that this is an intravenous drug. So the people who were treated had to come in once a month for the intravenous infusion, just once a month. And so that group alone lost really impressive amount of weight in a sense because it was all fat. And then the semaglutide group, the composition of weight loss, as usual, semaglutide lost 10 to 15% average weight loss, which is quite a good weight loss. But here again, there was a reasonable amount of lean mass loss in that group. And then when you put the two drugs together, there was still a small amount of lean mass loss, but it was very small. And the weight loss was a very, very large percentage of it was fat.
Yeah, wasn't it about 92%?
Over 90% weight loss was fat.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
Were they similar? So if we go back to the step one, were you involved with step one? I can't remember.
No, not directly. Okay. Yeah.
If we go back to the mixture or the differences in percentages of lean mass loss or fat-free mass loss, is it similar when they looked at the semaglutide only groups? Pretty similar? Yeah. Like
it was in the same range.
30%.
Yeah. Roughly okay. A third or a fourth. That depends on a lot of factors. Yeah.
Just an aside, we've had this before. For some reason, tirzepatide looks better in terms of fat free mass losses. Do you have any ideas? I think it's fluid shift differences, but I can't explain why it would be a higher percentage in semaglutide versus tirzepatide.
I think until we had them head to head with equivalent amounts of weight loss, we won't really know. I can't think of any reason why that would be the case, but probably should keep an open mind about it.
Yeah. Okay. It was just an aside because I've always racked my brain. We've had Dr. Tinsley on multiple times trying to go through these numbers, and it's just really interesting, but also the drawbacks of using a DEXA scan versus a multi-component other ways of assessing it. What did you guys use? Just DEXA scan? Did you use any other ways of assessing body composition?
Just DEXA in that study, but Novartis did do MRI scans and saw roughly the same thing, same effects, but not in well-designed studies for the current discussion.
So the interesting thing, it doesn't look like there was a plateau at the end of the 48 weeks. You said it went longer than 48 weeks. Did they keep losing? Because it looks like 20, over 20%.
I think 68 weeks was the primary endpoint, if I'm not mistaken. But then they went out a little longer after that. And since then, they've done a follow-up on drug off period, withdrawal of the drugs.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are you allowed to give us any insights of that or probably not?
I think overall the weight comes back in all our groups, as does most of the biomarkers like the blood cholesterol, things like that. Most of it comes back. There's some nuances, but that's the main picture.
Do people lose their muscle that they gained when they come off of the bimagrumab?
I think that's still an open question. That I'm not sure about the answer to. And there's some bone changes, as you probably know, that you lose some bone density when you lose weight. We're still looking at that kind of data.
It's interesting. What a lot of people were asking us, like, what can you make of the LDL cholesterol changes from the bimagrumab?
Well,
those increased.
In our current study, there was a transient rise in LDL cholesterol. I say transient because it did go up with bimagrumab treatment, and it slowly came down. But the opposite is true for weight loss in general. Normally, your LDL goes down when you lose weight to some extent. And so that was a unanticipated adverse effect, but it's known for this class of drugs. It's not totally unheard of. And it's a topic of great discussion because, as you know, LDL is the coronary artery risk factor, main one that we look at. And so people have been very concerned about it. The exact mechanism of it isn't entirely clear.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Yes.
And did you look at function of these people? Because everybody, one of the common complaints or the, you know, criticisms of the fat-free mass loss is like, well, whatever, as long as people are getting more functional activities of daily living, like if we increase the fat-free mass loss or protect against the loss, is that going to improve outcomes? What do you think?
I think this is a great question, and people are still debating the answer to that one. But for the most part, people who lose weight, a modest amount of weight, we'll say 10 or 15% weight, generally feel better.
Mm-hmm.
For the most part, they're more ambulatory, they get around better. And when you question them using scales, there are two scales we use, the SF-36 and the IWQOL. Those are two physical activity scales. Those scales improved in everybody, even the placebo group to some extent, but they improved. They did not get worse. So these are scales like how far can you walk? How do you feel when you go up the stairs? Things like that. They improved. They improved more in the people who got bimagrumab. Improved more, but not statistically significant for the most part. But the direction was a more positive direction. Those improved in everyone, including the antibody-treated patients, even greater. But grip strength, we also did. And it turns out grip strength is not a great measure in these kinds of studies because there's a learning curve. The more you squeeze on that grip strength meter, the better you get at it. So again, the placebo group who got basically nothing, they also improved. Their grip strength improved over time, as did all of the groups treated with drug. It improved more in the people who got the bimagrumab, but not statistically significant.
Mm. There are a lot of bodybuilders looking at this, you know, athletes looking at this drug. And I'd love to know whether it, like, you just gain the mass and it doesn't really help your strength versus not. I don't know if are there any, like, trials looking at that with formal weightlifting protocols or anything like that?
There are. Those studies are in progress. In fact, a number of them are just getting underway. Because this isn't the only drug. I say there are at least 10 that I know of that are from other companies that are looking at these effects. And they're more wise now, based on our study, including feedback from the FDA on what the FDA considers a good measure of function. So there are a number of different functional tests. For example, in the study we're about to start, a stair climb power is the primary outcome measure. Stair climb power is thought to be a better functional measurement than something like grip strength, or chair stand is another one. People are looking at components like balance, walking tests, and so on. So there's a lot of development now on the functional outcomes.
That's super interesting.
Yeah.
Grant, what do you have probably some burning questions about this. Did you take a look at the manuscript at all?
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, I did. Well, it's neat to, you know, Steve, hear you talk about it. Because, yeah. I mean, yeah, looking at it, when I saw the 9 groups initially, my eyes just got big. And it is impressive from the design standpoint, but it's really interesting to hear you talk about kind of how that actually came to be. But no, I mean, just the percent of weight loss from fat mass is so interesting because, again, as Spencer mentioned, you know, in his clinic, they really push the appropriate nutrition, the exercise, all these components. And it's kind of like a best case scenario when someone loses over 90% of their weight as fat mass while they're on one of these medications. So to see the group average that then is over 90% with the combination of the drugs is just kind of incredible. And
yeah.
You know, I think we're probably all fairly pro exercise, and I think there are a lot of health benefits of exercise beyond just body composition. So I don't know that we'll ever truly get the exercise and a pill, but just purely from the body composition standpoint, it's just incredible to see that combination. And out of, yeah, again, hundreds of people, how you can have the group average that normally we think of as an actual best case.
I could pick up on a comment you just made. First of all, we focused on the sort of the bodybuilder types of measurements, but the inflammatory marker, C-reactive protein, was profoundly improved in the antibody-treated groups. And people have really thought a lot about that. Of course, that's related to insulin resistance, diabetes risk, and so on. And visceral adipose tissue practically disappeared totally in the antibody-treated groups. So, the more beneficial effects seem to be on these metabolic markers than just the strength measures per se.
Steve, do you know, I know there wasn't MRI in this study, but do you know of any trials with this particular antibody that have looked at things like fat infiltration in the muscle or the liver?
They have shown that fat infiltration of muscle is reduced with these drugs. Yes, definitely. That's correct.
Because that's impressive if they're having, an increase, say with the drug alone, the antibody alone, getting an increase in lean mass overall, but also an improvement of muscle quality. That's fantastic.
Did you evaluate any of these patients personally? Like, I want to hear what they say. Like, I don't think I've seen any Reddit trial. Like, people will post online what they were like, but have you talked with any of these people on the drug?
Not so many, but sometimes they have adverse events. I get to see them. So there's some muscle cramps people get on the drugs or injection site reactions. None of those are terribly serious, but they do occur. And the other thing we found in some of our studies, people lose a ton of weight with the combination, and you have to stop them. We had a cutoff BMI of 22.
Mm-hmm.
And think about that, 22. I wish my BMI was 22 right now. And so we had people who started out a BMI at 35 and they're hit 22. And then we say, you got to stop or slow down or, because as there's a risk of eating disorders and adverse events and low BMIs. So that's when I get to see him at that point.
Here's a question. Why'd you pick 22 specifically? And I'll tell you why I say that.
I didn't personally. I want to say the drug companies seem to have settled on that number. Maybe it's just a cultural thing with the drug companies. But BMI 22, I would say, is very close to what, your ideal college student when they're healthy and haven't gained too much weight. Their BMIs are in that range.
So the reason I say that is because without knowing what the companies did in the past, when I was developing protocols, I created a program called Sequence, which was bought by Weight Watchers. And I said, we need to make sure people don't go past 22. I picked it out because I was like, clinically, if they go lower than this, I don't think they're going to have any clinical benefit. I never in my current clinic, we don't stop people there. I try to, the analogy of like landing a plane, like if they're going fast towards that, we start going, let's reduce it till they kind of fall right around there. But interesting, you all have had that number. What about, aren't they developing a subcutaneous version instead of getting infusions of this stuff?
I don't know exactly how you knew that, but yes, the answer is yes, that's well underway. You have to do all the pharmacokinetics and all of that before you start putting in trials. But yes, a subcutaneous version is feasible. Maybe all the way down the line, an oral version as well. In fact, some of the drugs we're testing for this effect are oral medications.
People are worried about cardiac muscle and organ size with these. Is that a hypothetical or a theoretical concern and not just looking at muscle?
Very good question. So far, at least for this drug, they've studied cardiac effects and there are no effects on increasing cardiac mass, which would probably be an adverse event.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just saw that like Lilly stopped looking at this, is anybody going to, I mean, I don't even know if this might be trade secret, so you might not be able to say, but like, this drug seems great. I'd love to take this drug personally.
Lilly, of course, I don't know what's going on at Lilly internally. There's been a lot of discussion about it. Lilly has such a deep lineup of drugs, not just tirzepatide, but now they have triple agonists. They have oral medications. And so I think probably they're putting in perspective their whole lineup. That's all I can think of.
Okay.
Clearly, the mechanism, though, is still of great interest, and they're not the only players anymore. There are others out there.
Go ahead.
Let me jump in with it. Well, related to the mechanism, it's interesting. It's just briefly mentioned in the paper, but it's mentioned about how with semaglutide, for example, and the GLP-1 receptor agonist, we know there's an effect on reducing appetite, reducing energy intake. But there's just a small note on bimagrumab not appearing to affect food intake, but just primarily affecting the signaling directly. It's a little hard to wrap your head around. Do you have any other comments on that mechanism and how it's working, say, as a standalone drug that's producing the weight loss?
Yes. So you picked up an absolutely fascinating point. Let's take the drug alone, bimagrumab alone, and you give it to people, and they lose 7% of their weight, and they lose a lot of fat, and they gain lean. That was the observation, the trial. They didn't reduce their intake. Their intake remained constant. So how can that happen? Because you're in negative energy balance. So something else has to give. Am I right?
Energy
intake's constant. Energy losses are negative. So something else has to happen. And I talked to Ronan Rubinoff, who developed the drug, about this. And he said, of course, they did studies earlier that were never published, which shows that there's some degree of increase in energy expenditure.
Yeah.
But again, not studied carefully yet. That would be an amazing study to do. If we could get some drug, we would do that study, right?
It seems like the increase would have to be pretty large in expenditure to get
decently.
Because we know, like skeletal muscle, it has a decently high resting metabolic rate, but not compared to the high metabolic rate organs. I think that's overstated, sometimes how much of an effect it will have. So that's fascinating.
I said the same thing. I said, you probably need a pretty big increase. And then he pulled out his calculations and showed me what they measured, added up to the amount of fat loss. So I'll tell you, that would be the study on a metabolic ward to do, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
You guys have a metabolic ward at Pennington?
We do. We do. They just have to give us the drug and some money and we would do it.
We need to get you some money.
I guarantee if the drug went forward, they would do it because we do all of the metabolic adaptation studies here. We've done semaglutide, tirzepatide. Haven't seen much there that they prevent metabolic adaptation when you lose weight, those two drugs. So we're a center that does that kind of work, but we haven't. Yeah, it's great that you picked up on that observation. How is that possible? It doesn't seem possible, does it?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I love that, just that the mechanism is distinct. And you talked about in the paper, you got these like additive fat loss because of the different mechanisms. So it'd be amazing, like you said, on the energy expenditure side with the GLP-1 receptor agonist, it's been kind of underwhelming. It doesn't seem like there's too much going on. So if this did have this distinct effect on the energy expenditure side, that's just so interesting.
Fascinating, yeah.
There's obviously a nutrient partitioning effect. So if you're losing adipose and gaining a little bit of muscle, but you're clearly losing, you're still losing more.
Yeah, it can't account for all of it, but you're right. You're putting some energy into lean and taking it out of fat. That's correct.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
What is your overall, are you pretty positive on this drug? You think that eventually, just in your own personal opinion and based on looking at these improved despite the LDL cholesterol changes.
Yeah.
I'm a lipidologist, so I'm a board certified clinical lipidologist as well. I'm not so concerned about it because we have such so many other drugs that, like, if it really were a worry, we'll just take care of it. But yeah. Like, what is your gestalt on whether these drugs move forward?
I think the dream would be that you go 10 or so years down the line, that when people went on a diet, they just lost body fat. And to do that, we're going to have to create drugs now that go beyond reducing your appetite. They're going to have to affect these pathways that we had never even considered before. In fact, we don't really know how muscle and fat are related to each other. We know that people who are obese have more muscle, and we just assume that that's because they carry a greater load, and the load produces more muscle. But there may be other factors. Maybe there's crosstalk between adipose tissue and muscle in ways that we don't really understand. I think there's a lot more we're going to learn now from all of this.
I love it. Ooh, one more question.
Yeah.
When you lose weight with one of these incretins, whether it's tirzepatide, semaglutide, and you lose that ratio of fat mass and fat-free mass, is there any, and I don't believe there is there any data on the people that regain weight and the composition of that weight that is regained? Meaning, is it similar to the weight, the composition that was lost, or is it like you start regaining more adipose compared to the fat-free mass?
No, I'll tell you what the daily newspaper says, which is, oh, you regain all the fat. Mm-hmm. All the data we've seen so far is the composition of the weight regain is the same as the composition of the weight loss.
Very good.
If you go long enough.
Yeah.
If you just go out a month or two, there's maybe some more fat. But now if you wait long enough, it's all back.
Perfect.
Yeah,
that's what I've been preaching. I was hoping I'd ask the absolute expert on this to make sure I'm not preaching incorrectly. So any questions you have, Grant, Dr. Tinsley?
I mean, I'm sure we could go all day on thinking about these, but no, I think the major ones were answered. Again, I think it's just so interesting because of the different mechanisms involved here and combinations. So yeah, Steve, being able to pick your brain directly on this is a pleasure.
Yeah, someday I'm going to request, I want to go visit you at the Pennington and see how you guys run things. We appreciate everything you all do down there. So thank you so much for coming on. It's really a pleasure to have you.
I'm so glad. Enjoyed the discussion.
Very good. All right, everyone. Okay. If you have a friend or family member or anybody that's interested in myostatin and these newer drugs coming out, make sure you share this. Go and rate us on the Apple or Spotify or wherever the heck. Make sure you give us a 5. If not, please don't rate us.
Okay.
Thanks again. Here's our outro.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities. We'll be right back.